Hi, podcast listeners. Great program tonight, as all sorts of deadlines are missed by the Trump administration to provide evidence to Congress. We drill down into whether this is a constitutional crisis. And we get to talk to Norm Orenstein, who's been a longtime congressional observer, and he is the expert. And also to Susan Glasser of The New Yorker, who's been writing about this and how it is not business as usual between the White House and Congress. And then I talked to Madawi al-Rashid. She's a Saudi Arabian professor here at the London School of Economics, and she's telling us about the increased and stepped up repression inside Saudi Arabia. We're talking about the 37 men who were executed in one fell swoop last week, and how some of them have said that their so-called confessions were extracted under torture, and particularly how so many women are being put into prison, and even the lawyers that are defending them. Then Walter Isaacson has a great conversation with Stanley Nelson, who's documented the African-American experience like no other. He's talking about how they managed to come up with businesses despite the crushing inequality because of racism. Enjoy the show. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. It's a day of missed deadlines for President Trump and his administration, with the Attorney General William Barr declining to provide the unredacted Mueller report to Congress by its 9 a.m. deadline this morning. It's dramatically ratcheting up the drama as a congressional panel will now vote on whether to hold Barr in contempt on Wednesday. And it comes as President Trump made an about-face on the special counsel testifying before Congress. After initially saying that he would support Barr's decision on the matter, he tweeted this morning, Bob Mueller should not testify. Meanwhile, the clock is also running down on Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. After missing two previous deadlines, he's set to reveal whether he'll actually comply with Congress and release the president's tax returns, something Mr. Trump has been refusing to do since his candidacy began back in 2015. So what are we seeing here? Is this an extreme version of the usual cut and thrust that happens between different branches of government? Or are we witnessing the route to a constitutional crisis? Joining me with answers are two experts, Susan Glasser, a staff writer for The New Yorker, and author Norman Orenstein, a political scientist and longtime congressional expert. Welcome, both of you, to the program.
Thank you.
Let me ask you the question that I posited. What do you make, Norman, all the way over there in Poland, and you've been studying this for a long, long time, of this reluctance by, you know, the Department of Justice highest official, the Attorney General, basically flouting this congressional deadline? What should we make of it?
This is not business as usual, Christiane. This really is a difference. We've had, of course, other cabinet members who have had disputes with Congress, including Eric Holder and the Obama administration. We've had contempt citations issued. We've had delays. But in the past, it's always been resolved through some kind of negotiation. This, in terms of the volume, the blanket refusal to cooperate, the direct challenges to the authority of Congress from the Justice Department, from the president, from a whole series of cabinet agencies, is simply unprecedented in our modern age, at least. And it is leading to a constitutional crisis.
So you think it is. Let me ask you, Susan Glasser, if you agree with that sort of maximalist interpretation of what's happening, that it is leading to a constitutional crisis. And if so, what exactly does that mean and what does it look like? Including, of course, Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, so far not saying what he's going to do about the tax returns.
Well, that's right. It's a good point. It's not just about the Mueller report. And I think that's something important for people to realize is that essentially President Trump has decided to thumb his nose at the broad range of congressional investigations. And there are many, that are ongoing since the Democrats have taken control of the House of Representatives. The president has basically directed his staff not to cooperate at all with the new Democratic House. And essentially, he's daring them. He sees that he has retained the Republican-controlled Senate. He believes that there are not 20 Republican senators who are going to break ranks with him and ever go for a move to impeach and remove him from office. As a matter of politics, I should say, that remains, I think, a fairly accurate reading of the situation here in Washington. But as it is typical with President Trump, he is going to the nth degree with this strategy. And that's where I think Norm is right to say it's something different than we've experienced in the past. Previous presidents didn't want to dial up the confrontation with Congress. They often wanted to dial it down. And it seems that President Trump is almost daring the House of Representatives to go farther, perhaps even daring them to impeach him and seeing that there's potential political benefit for himself in alarming his Republican base in advance of the 2020 presidential election. But it really, what it means is that we're headed down a course of confrontation because these are co-equal branches of government under our Constitution. And so that leaves potentially the courts to referee this fight, which is always a risky situation. Mm-hmm.
So you've just brought in the courts, which is obviously the other branch of the American government. Norm, you know, it's really fascinating to hear what Susan just said and what you've just said. What would a constitutional crisis look like? And I ask because many people say, and particularly people around the world, and obviously people in the United States as well, that the health of the American institutions is robust, and that no matter what happens, no matter whether a president challenges them more than another one, the institutions still remain and they can still, you know, carry out their constitutional requirements, their constitutional duties.
So we have seen some heartening things over the course of the last 2 years. We have had some independence on the part of the judiciary when it came to, for example, the travel bans that the president instituted. We've seen a few instances where courts have stepped up. But one thing that I've learned from my visit this time in Europe is something that I knew before, but it's been reinforced. No society is immune from a slide towards autocracy. A direct challenge to the fundamentals of this system won't necessarily hold. And we have seen our judges become tribalized and partisanized along the same lines that we've seen in Congress and in our politics more generally. And it wouldn't be surprising with the degree to which Trump has been able to stack the courts. He's now picked about a sixth of all the appeals court judges in the country. There is a clear Republican majority on the Supreme Court that they might uphold a level of executive power that would pretty much make Congress an impotent body. Now, that's not to say that it would hold for a long time. It wouldn't surprise me if there were a Democratic president down the road with a Republican Congress that they would say, never mind, just as we saw with Bush v. Gore, which was a one-time thing. But this is dangerous territory, and a president and a broad set of institutions stonewalling like this, and as Susan said, not just on the Mueller report, an attorney general whose only parallel would be John Mitchell during the Nixon administration, but many more cabinet officers who are in the same category. This is really a place we don't want to be.
So, right now it's all about oversight, or a lot of it is about oversight and trying to hold the administration, the president accountable. So to that end, Congressman Jerry Nadler was saying that, you know, if we cannot get our requests met, for instance, with Attorney General William Barr, that really does affect the way the American democracy is able to, you know, remain healthy and transparent for the people. But he also injected a bit of a fear for the future. I'm just going to play this little bit of what he said last week.
This is a grave danger for American democracy, and we must do all we can in the name of the American people to ensure that when the Trump administration ends, we have as robust a democracy to hand to our children as was handed to us.
So it's very interesting the way he puts it. And to both of you, and I'll ask you first, Susan, he also said in a different part of that address to the press that, you know, what's going on is a little bit the difference between a democracy and a dictatorship. A democracy requires the consistent checks and balances of the institutions and transparency and accountability. What do you make, Susan, of what he said and the way he threw the gauntlet down there? I mean, is that over-egging it, or is it that dramatic, do you think?
Well, he has used fairly apocalyptic language the other day in suggesting that nothing less than the future of democracy is at stake in whether or not Attorney General Barr complies with the subpoena for the unredacted Mueller report and the underlying evidence. It's an interesting debate. You said earlier in the program, is this the constitutional crisis? What's amazing about the Trump presidency is that almost every single day since he was inaugurated, people have been asking themselves one way or the other, is this it? Is this the crisis? Is this the moment? And to me, that suggests, number one, that actually President Trump himself is the crisis, right? And it takes many different forms. Number two, the issue of the role of Congress and the role of the courts is really come into focus in a way that it hasn't in any other presidency of my adult lifetime, certainly. Is it a crisis for Congress to move forward with investigating the president or for the courts to enact decisions against the executive branch? Arguably not. Arguably, that's exactly how our system of government is supposed to work, right? Those checks and balances that you referred to. On the other hand, for Trump to pursue again and again a strategy of confrontation with the other branches of government in hopes of testing their limits and their boundaries, I think that's what Chairman Jerry Nadler is referencing here, mm-hmm. that if Congress doesn't act, that's when you might have a crisis. If it fails to perform the oversight responsibilities, they're the only way in our system of imposing accountability on a president. Otherwise, there really is unchecked, almost dictatorial power that we've invested in the White House if Congress won't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. And Norm, what would a, you know, contempt of Congress look like, as they're suggesting might happen if, for instance, the Attorney General does not comply and reveal the unredacted, the full Mueller report? What does it mean practically?
Look, before I get to that, Christiane, let me underscore something Susan said earlier. If this were simply a dispute between Congress and the president, I wouldn't be as worried. But we don't have a single Republican in the House or Senate who's objected to lying by cabinet members. Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, for example, who stood up after Barr testified in front of the Senate and dissembled repeatedly, offering any unease about it. So that's one of the real problems we have here. It's not just Congress against the president. It's a Democratic House against Republicans in the House, the Senate, and the president. Now, beyond that, the power that Congress has to start with is to hold officials in contempt or to impeach them. Impeaching them requires a Senate that would go along with 2/3, and right now, no Republicans would do that. Contempt means going to the courts, and where we've seen that occur in the past, it can take months and months. Now, if we go back in history, Congress actually has an inherent contempt authority. There's a jail in the Congress, in the Capitol. They could send out Capitol Police or U.S. Marshals and arrest the Attorney General, in theory, and put him in jail. But, of course, that's not going to happen. And the fact is, we rely on the norms of this process as much as we do the rules and the laws. And in this case, the law isn't going to work because contempt could lead us all the way through the remainder of this presidential term, and the norms have broken down completely. And that's where our crisis is. It's more in the breakdown of norms.
So given the breakdown of norms that you describe, President Trump came in as a self-declared disruptor of norms. I mean, he just said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm not going to be politically correct. I'm going to say it like I see it. And I am going to change things because that's what voters want. So, again, the question is this just Trump being Trump? And do the norms, in a way, have to, or must they, because he's the president, sort of expand and shift a little bit for as long as he's president. I mean, for instance, the bit about Mueller testifying in front of Congress in public. You know, he's saying the Democrats are looking for a redo, that they've already stolen, those are his words, 2 years of the presidency. Does he have a point as a constitutional matter? What is the constitutional significance of Mueller, for instance, being called to testify?
Well, Christian, I think this is an important point. First of all, Trump, you know, is making a ridiculous argument in many ways. The notion that it's a redo to have Mueller testify and tell the public about this 2-year investigation that the public paid for, you know, of course that's not a redo. That's how the system is supposed to work. It's literally an absurd argument. And that goes to your broader point. Trump would love nothing more for the American public just to see him as some sort of truth teller who's telling uncomfortable facts to the snooty elite and, you know, just challenging political correctness. But, you know, the legal theories and the view of the presidency itself that he and his advisors are advancing is a direct contravention of the system of government that the founders envisioned. And it's not just, you know, telling uncomfortable truths to have the Attorney General of the United States testify under oath, as he did last week in the United States Senate. And William Barr said it was a breathtaking moment. He said the President of the United States, in his view, has so much power that he can shut down any investigation of himself if he believes it to be unfair. That is the most sweeping assertion of executive power that Americans have heard since Richard Nixon said to David Frost that actually it's not illegal if the president does it. And, you know, I don't think that's just being politically correct or politically incorrect, as the case may be. That's just a shocking statement.
You know, to that point, a former congressional counsel tells the Wall Street Journal, quote, the entire system of checks and balances depends on Congress constantly looking at how the country is being governed. He was a former general counsel who says that. So clearly, you know, that is the foundation of what makes the United States, you know, this bastion of democracy, rule of law, and all the other values that the United States stands for. And I want to put it that way because, Norm, you are in Poland, you're in Warsaw, at the heart of what is a very close U.S. ally, you know, fought the certainly, you know, the non-communist Poles fought during the war on the Allied side. They've had concentration camps in their own country. You've just witnessed a commemoration of some of that, and you're seeing what they're doing in terms of trampling the rule of law. Just explain what Poland is doing and what kind of, I suppose, contagious effect that can have in our democracies.
Well, you know, what we're seeing in Poland, as we have seen across Europe, not just Central and Eastern Europe, but now in Western Europe, in Italy, with the rise of a power on the right in Spain, in so many countries, and we're seeing it here, obviously, tangibly now, is a move away from democracy back towards autocracy. And in some countries, it's moving more rapidly than others. There's a challenge to fundamental authorities and to the democratic norms. And Trump has accelerated that. When we see other strong boot figures like Erdogan and Duterte using the term enemy of the people to jail their own press, we're seeing this play out in a lot of places. It's not just the United States. And many of the forces that brought us to where we are in the United States preceded Trump, and he's just accelerated them. But once you've lost some of that sense of how a democracy is supposed to work and how checks and balances are supposed to work, it's not easy to get them back. And one of the things about Trump is he knows, as he said himself 2 years ago, I could shoot somebody in broad daylight on Fifth Avenue and I wouldn't lose a single vote. 40% or so of Americans are with him no matter what. They don't care that he's shattering the norms. A substantial number of them would be perfectly happy with a dictatorship. And that makes it much more difficult. And it makes it particularly difficult because his own party is acting, in the phrase of Lindsey Graham, who's been as big a perpetrator as anybody, for party over country. That's a dangerous thing. It's an unusual thing. And it is something we haven't seen in the 50 years at least that I've been around Washington and our politics.
So, Susan, lastly to you then, because you're sitting right there in Washington, you know, what Norm just said about a significant number of Americans, you know, wouldn't mind a strong man or some kind of a dictatorship. He's actually quoting a poll which actually suggested as much. I mean, just to be clear, he's not just saying that out of nowhere. And it was shocking when it came out. But I wonder how you reacted to what Nancy Pelosi has said in an interview to the New York Times, that the Democrats should be careful about the whole impeachment, rush to impeachment and concentrating on that. And they need to be careful about the next election because she sees a possibility that President Trump could cry foul and question an election that didn't go his way. How seriously is that all being dissected in Washington this time?
Well, it was a striking comment, and I think you're right to highlight it. But remember, this was also said in the run-up to the 2016 election. As you recall, there was a lot of fears that Trump, he was expected to lose, of course, and a lot of people thought at that time he might not recognize the outcome of the election. Obviously, that's one of many might-have-beens we don't know the answer to because he did win in that upset. In my own view, there is a raging debate here in Washington right now over not only whether Democrats in the House should proceed with impeachment proceedings, even though they know they are very likely doomed to fail in terms of actually removing Trump from office. But there are consequences on the other side of the ledger, too. The politics of impeachment might look one way in a set of polls taken today, but from the long view of history, what would be the consequence of Democrats saying we can't proceed for political reasons against Trump and leaving, therefore, unchallenged many of the extraordinary actions he has taken in his 2 years in office. Let's not forget that he attempted to fire the special counsel, ordered his aides to do so. He did, in fact, fire the FBI director and fire his own first attorney general in the effort to shut down an investigation of himself. These are significant challenges to not only norms, but to laws in any other circumstance. They're challenges to Congress's authority. And if Nancy Pelosi and Democrats in the House leave these uncontested actions, I think that's the other part of the political debate over President Trump. And so it's not resolved here. That's why you see them proceeding with the investigations, because nobody is quite sure how any of this is actually going to turn out. But Norm is right. 40% of the American public still supports Donald Trump. You know, you can't look away from that fact. So much has happened in the last 2.5 years, and yet the polls have remained amazingly, even shockingly, consistent. And so that's the political reality in which this is all playing out here in Washington, and it's pretty unbelievable.
And by the way, according to the latest poll, an even higher number support his handling of the economy, something like 56%. So that puts all of this in stark perspective. Susan Glasser, Norm Orenstein, thank you very much indeed for joining me this evening. Now, as these confrontations continue, it is not the only area where the Trump administration and Congress clash. Saudi Arabia is another major flashpoint. While President Trump has been keen on building the relationship with the Saudi kingdom, come what may, the legislative branch is denouncing the nation for its role in Yemen's 4-year war and, of course, for the murder and dismemberment of journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Turkey last October. Less than 2 weeks ago, Saudi Arabia executed 37 men for, quote, terrorism. But court documents reveal that defendants told the judge they were tortured into confessions. Arwood Damon has an exclusive interview with a Saudi lawyer who defended some of those men. He told her that he started receiving messages trying to make him come home, just like Jamal Khashoggi received messages. Here's her report.
17 and arrested for protesting.
I was sleep deprived, tortured, and coerced into confessing something I didn't do.
An interrogator threatens this 16-year-old.
If you don't validate your confession, I will kill your father and your mother.
And this young man, also claiming he was abused in custody.
The confession was written by the interrogator. I signed it only after torture and threats.
These are statements made in a Saudi court by some of the 37 whose death sentences were carried out in the second largest mass execution in the kingdom's recent history. Taha al-Hajj is haunted by their stories. He was a lawyer in his former homeland of Saudi Arabia, where he briefly represented some of those executed in April on what he calls trumped up and bogus spying and terrorism charges. The day of their execution, the Saudi government said justice had been served. But hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents exclusively obtained by CNN lay bare another narrative.
The court documents are proof of torture and injustice, and they still have the audacity to say they are merciful and humane.
The defendants say that they confessed because they were being tortured. That should have been investigated under Saudi law.
The judge is supposed to take this seriously, to ask the interrogators for an answer to these allegations. But what happens in most of these cases is that the judge ignores it.
Saudi Arabia has denied accusations of torture in the past, and the Saudi government has not responded to CNN's numerous queries about the allegations of confession under torture, as stated in the court documents. Among the crimes the dead are accused of committing: demonstrating, violence, spying, organizing demonstrations, filming misleading videos, and communicating with foreign media. Taha suspects that the government might have also accused him of false crimes. While still in Saudi, he received a call asking him to appear at a police station. He fled the same day. But even here in Germany, he is wary of the far-reaching tentacles of the Saudi government.
It's a very politely worded letter from the Saudi embassy here that he got on his phone. How did they get your number?
I don't know how they got my number. This was a new number.
The message from someone claiming to be a Saudi official in Berlin says, "The homeland still welcomes its sons with open arms. And if you want, I could help you go back. I guarantee you an easy return that you will thank me for."
CNN has obtained exclusive new video in the murder investigation of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi.
A few months later, the news of the brutal murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi dominated the headlines. He, too, had received similar assurances from Saudi officials.
I thought to myself, I could be in the same state as Jamal if I had agreed. It brought this to my mind right away.
He says his government could try to get to him, even here, but he will not stop using his freedom to be a voice for those who are still inside, for those who are being tortured and abused, for those who can't scream, even when they are in pain. Arwa Damon, CNN, Berlin.
So let me just read a statement that the Saudi authorities did give. Now, it wasn't in response to the allegations of torture and confessions under torture, but it was in response to questions about that mass execution. And this is what they have said. Justice was served. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has long ago adopted a zero-tolerance policy towards terrorists who spill the blood of the innocent, threaten the national security of the kingdom, and distort our great faith. The convicted criminals who were executed had their day in court and were found guilty of very serious crimes. So for more on all of this, I'm joined by Saudi scholar Madawi Al-Rashid. She's a visiting professor at the London School of Economics Middle East Center, and she's with me here on the set. Madawi Al-Rashid, welcome to the program. You know, you've been a critic for a long time. You've watched what the government's been doing for a long time. Where does this, first of all, mass execution fit into a country that in any event has the death penalty? And you heard what I read, that justice has been served.
Well, it fits very well. And since the beginning of 2019, we had 104 executions. But the shocking thing was the mass execution and also the crucifixion.
Explain that. What do you mean?
Well, usually the beheading takes place, but in one particular prisoner case, after beheading, he was crucified, and there were reports that he was on display. But it is in line with what Saudi Arabia does. The death penalty is upheld in Saudi Arabia, but the worrying thing is the judiciary that is not independent. So in a, We know that death penalty exists in democracies and in autocratic regimes, but when there is no way to challenge the courts, and the courts are under the authority of the Ministry of Interior, or even higher in this particular moment, under the authority of the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, then it is very difficult to see how justice is done.
Can I just put up a graphic that we do have with a list of those countries, because you did mention that, you know, there are death penalty even in some democracies like the United States. Let's just put that up and just say that Amnesty International on 2018 global executions listed China as being the one who executed the most. There are no numbers, actually, because the data is not public. Iran, then Saudi Arabia is number three. Vietnam, Iraq, Egypt, the United States is seventh on that list. Before we get to some of the, you know, some of the points of why Saudi Arabia says they executed these people, you know, when there is a country like the United States, which also has the death penalty, what then is the mitigating ability of diplomacy or appeal to human rights or appeal to their allies? Saudi Arabia is a big ally of the United States. Mohammed bin Salman is somebody the United States has taken a major gamble on, so certainly the Trump administration. They believe he's their man. What can the U.S. do in these instances?
Well, the U.S. doesn't want to do anything, especially at this particular moment. We have seen how Saudi Arabia and the Saudi regime itself got away with murdering a journalist in the consulate in Istanbul on the 2nd of October. And Mr. Trump at the time said maybe they did it, maybe they didn't. And even when he was confronted with the report of his own intelligence services, he refused to take any notice. So at the moment, those who are calling for human rights, calling for open trials, open representation and lawyers to defend those people who in an independent court are really having no support from governments in the West. What they are getting is quite a lot of media coverage and also support from the international global human rights organization, such as Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and from the UN, of course.
Yeah, and indeed, Amnesty has talked about sham trials that violated international fair trial standards, which relied on confessions extracted through torture. We'll talk about that in a moment. And you mentioned the UN. The head of the UN Human Rights Commission, Michelle Bachelet, it's particularly abhorrent that at least three of those killed were minors at the time of their sentencing. What do you think is going on? What do you think is the real reason? Some people say it's because they had links to Iran, and obviously there's a war of words, at least, between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Well, it is a message to Iran, but I think the real victims are the community in Saudi Arabia, and that is the Shia community of the Eastern Province. The
message, which is a minority in Saudi Arabia.
Which is a minority in Saudi Arabia, and it had been at the forefront of protest in a very, very peaceful way. And the Saudis did this kind of execution in 2016 when they executed an important Shia cleric by the name of Nimr al-Nimr. And what happened was that Iran condemned the execution of this Shia cleric. And then immediately after that, the Saudi embassy in Tehran was attacked, and then the relationship deteriorated. So the Iranians didn't stop the mobs attacking the Saudi embassy. But I think the execution are actually a domestic matter, although the message might get to Iran. Domestically, Mohammed bin Salman is ruling by fear and by repression. And these kind of mass executions, which amount to a massacre, 37 people in one day, it's quite a lot. And also lumping together different people, different categories of people. One of the executed was a Shia religious scholar who was invited to the National Dialogue Forum established under the rule of King Abdullah to talk about Sunni-Shia relations. Quite a lot of the executed, we have evidence, we have YouTube clips saying that those people are giving lectures or mobilizing others. And I did not see any kind of sectarian tone in their speeches that they were given after 2011. Some of those people are very, very young. When they were arrested, they were only like under the age of 16. And they were peaceful demonstrators who got really carried away with the Arab uprising of 2011, but they were arrested at the time, and then we are in 2019 when they were executed.
Briefly, are you surprised that we're hearing, and this is what Arwa Damon's report was, that significant numbers of these who were executed told the court that they didn't mean what they said, that it was only extracted under torture, and they were told what to write?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, torture in Saudi prison is confirmed. It's confirmed by one woman activist, Lujain Al-Hudloul, who told her family during their monthly visit that she was tortured, that she was sexually abused, physically abused, and she didn't want to talk about these issues early on, fearing that that might make her situation worse in prison. But at the end, she had lost hope and told her family, her brother in Canada, Waleed, and her sister in Brussels. They were both talking to the media about the exact detail of horrific sexual abuse and torture in Saudi
prison. So let me just ask you a broader story then, because we've brought up women now. There are women who are in jail now, and reports from their families of abuse there. And there are women who are fleeing. Like it's stepped up quite significantly. There are a couple of public cases, you know, Bangkok, Hong Kong, etc., Saudi women. And what do you think is going on with this rather stepped up number of women and others who are seeking asylum abroad?
It's the only thing that is in common between these various cases of women activists in prison, of religious scholars in prison, of peaceful activists, lawyers who defend prisoners of conscience are in prison, and what we call the runaway girls. They tend to be very, very young. The common factor is actually they are fleeing repression. When things get really, really bad, they have no recourse. And in the case of the young girls, the state or the government agencies failed to provide protection against some kind of abuse within the family. In fact, the government becomes an accomplice in this when they reach out to foreign governments asking them to return the girls. So they enforce this situation and bring the young girls back to Saudi Arabia. But there are so many cases at the moment that we only hear about very high-profile ones. And also they have been using social media in order to publicize their case, so we know more about them. But there are young women in Saudi Arabia who are in so-called shelters, and these shelters, they can go to a state-run shelter if they are abused at home, but then in order to leave, they have to get their guardian to come and collect them, which means that sometimes you have to get the one who abuses you to come and sign the documents to get you out.
It's a phenomenal situation. I'm really glad we were able to highlight it, Madawi Al-Rashid, and particularly Human Rights Watch today has talked about this new app that Saudis are being used to stop women from being able to leave and give them permission to leave. So we're going to keep our eye on this. Thank you so much indeed for joining us. We turn now to our next guest, the Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker Stanley Nelson, who's widely considered the foremost chronicler of the African-American experience. His latest work, Boss, The Black Experience in Business, looks at the challenges faced by African-American business owners from the Civil War to the present day. And he sat down with our Walter Isaacson to discuss what drives his work, his production company, Firelight Media, and his upcoming film on jazz musician Miles Davis, which is set to release this summer.
Stanley Nelson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I was blown away by watching Boss. And we've all known the problem that African Americans have had since the Civil War in doing wealth creation. Mm-hmm. But what you show is how systematically the problem of wealth creation was, even starting right after the war, with the 40 acres and the mule not being a fulfilled promise. Tell me why you got onto that and what you were trying to show.
Well, I mean, I think the story of African-American businesses is just such a poignant one, and that it's a story that we don't know, and the resiliency of African-Americans in, you know, fighting through that and starting banks and hair care companies and insurance companies and in the tech industry now. And I thought it was I thought if I didn't make the film, who's going to make it? You know, and that it's not something that people are like, oh, yeah, that's a great idea for a film, but that it could be made as a film, and that's what we tried to do.
And it seems to break a lot of stereotypes, but also disrupt sort of this theme of America that we all have equal opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very clear that so many times, and there's so many different stories in the film, where African Americans start businesses or towns even, and they're destroyed, like, systematically. But I think that that's, you know, just to be clear, that's not the focus of the film. The focus really is on the starting of the business and the making the business succeed.
You talk about towns being destroyed because freed slaves and African Americans went out west to places like Oklahoma and started their own self-contained enclaves. We have a clip here. It's a part of Tulsa called Greenwood, and it's one of my favorite parts of the movie. Let's show it.
On May 30th, 1921, the mob came to Greenwood.
This white woman is in an elevator, and this black teenager allegedly whistles at her or talks to her. He is taken to jail. A mob gathers of whites and blacks, and blacks in Tulsa are armed. They take their Second Amendment rights seriously, and they come with guns. And this is a threat. Someone fires into the crowd, and the riot is born. This was not about the whistling boy in the elevator. This was about blacks becoming too economically powerful and showing that wealth in a way that anyone would by creating buildings and constructing churches and having property.
There was a whistle that blew, and then the mass invasion and the destruction of Greenwood began.
When the smoke cleared in the early morning of June 1st, 1921, Black Wall Street lay in ruins.
This is by far the largest single incident of racial violence in all of American history.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most amazing things about that clip is the footage, you know, is that we're able to tell this story because of this newly discovered footage of Greenwood. And you actually see the people in their homes. And right before what we saw is you see them kind of building the town, you know. Mm-hmm. You see them planting their gardens. You see black people on horseback herding cattle because they're in Oklahoma. And all of those things. And then you see the destruction of that. And it's just, it's very moving to me. You know, partially because you can really see it. You can visualize what the town was.
One of the things I learned was that the first real businesses were sort of services, whether it be barbershops or beauty and other things. How did that help pave the way for building of wealth?
One of the things that happened in the South was, you know, after the time of enslavement, as African Americans became free, many times they, black people took up the jobs that they kind of already were doing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I was a barber, you know, or if I that, you know, that was one of my duties, and I became had my own barbershop. If I worked in the field, then I became a farmer. You know, so a lot of those things led to the first businesses that African Americans had and led to a certain amount of economic freedom.
What were the obstacles, though, to real wealth accumulation?
Well, I mean, I think there were so many. You know, I mean, at first, and for a long time, as we show in the film, African Americans really only sold to African Americans. You know, you could have a store that sold to black folks, but what people really sometimes don't understand is that in most of this country, if you were even a black grocer, it was very hard to have a black grocery store that whites would frequent. So basically, for a lot of the history of the United States, after the Civil War, black people were having businesses that sold to black people. And so, you know, that in some ways is limiting. You can't borrow capital. You could not go to a bank and borrow money. That was somehow in some ways alleviated when black people started having their own banks. But, you know, you could, in so many places in this country, you couldn't even walk into a bank. But if you could, you couldn't get a loan.
One of the obstacles seems to be the big corporations. You have a wonderful sequence of Ursula Burns, who moves from being the executive's assistant to the CEO of Xerox to being the CEO herself. But she's a very unusual case. Why is it that it's hard for African Americans to become the boss?
Well, I think, you know, there's this ceiling above you, and it's not a glass ceiling. It's a real ceiling. One of the things that Ursula says in the section we have on Ursula is she says it was hard for me because what business looks at as excellence are white men. You know, that's what they, that's what, as she says, that's what it looks like, that's what it sounds like, you know, that's the model. And it's very hard for a black person, and especially for a black woman, to, you know, fit into that model. How do you fit in? If that's your standard of excellence, how do you break in? People do it, but you have to be extraordinary.
One of the entrepreneurs you've done a documentary on before, and then as part of this one, is Madam C.J. Walker. Tell me about who she was and how she created a business.
Yeah, so Madam C.J. Walker was a woman who, you know, pretty much started out with nothing in the South. She started working for a woman named Annie Malone, who had a company called Puro Products, a black beauty company in Chicago, out of Chicago. And Madam Walker said to herself, you know, I could do this, and I could do it better. And so Madam C.J. Walker, you know, moved to Indianapolis, started her own company, and just raised it from nothing until she had a whole series. I think it was 19 or 20 different products that she had. And again, is kind of in the Guinness Book of Records as the first woman to start with nothing and earn $1 million.
All of your documentaries almost deal with race from different angles. How does the arc of your career, how do you... put those together to say, here's the story I'm trying to tell.
I feel that people should tell their own stories, that stories are richer and deeper and more meaningful and more heartfelt if they're told by the people who live them. So I try to tell stories that I live, you know, that I think are important. Mm-hmm. But I also think in very general terms, I'm really interested in institutions and movements and things that are bigger than just, you know, the great man or woman of history.
Now, the film that's coming out soon, which I just loved what I got to see of it, is on Miles Davis.
Right.
And that seems a bit of a departure. I mean, you're doing somebody who is an artist and he just wakes up every morning with his music. In fact, let's do a clip about the importance of music to him.
Sure.
Music has always been like a curse with me. I've always felt driven to play it. It's the first thing in my life, go to bed thinking about it and wake up thinking about it. It's always there. It comes before everything.
Yeah, I mean, that's a beautiful clip. I mean, I think for me, you know, I'm a real music lover. I listen to music from the time I go to bed, the time I wake up, the time I go to bed. It's just something that and I've always wanted to do like a pure music film. And, you know, who's better than Miles, you know, because one, Miles' music is so great and so important and I believe will last forever. But two, Miles was a really complicated individual. You know, he's really complicated and it makes for a much richer film.
He was complicated, too, in his feelings about race, right? Because he gets beaten up once by a white deputy here in New York City, and it sort of scars him for the rest of his life. There's an anger there that's in his music sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that again, you know, Miles, there's so many facets to Miles to understand and try to unpack. And I always say that I think before you try to unpack anybody or anything, you have to first say that, you know, different people react to different stimuli and in different ways. So, you know, you might have lived or I might have lived the same thing and reacted differently. But Miles grew up, his father was a dentist, and Miles grew up in East St. Louis, and they were, for the standard for African Americans at that time, they were rich. Okay, they had a farm outside of the city. Miles had a horse, you know, that he would ride. I mean, you know, Miles grew up rich, but he also grew up black in segregated America, you know, in East St. Louis. So he had all that to pack on top of it. Also, Miles was very, very dark-skinned. And Miles was beautiful. You know, so we had that going on.
Let us show something about the blackness.
Sure.
That blackness is an amazing part of the movie.
Yeah.
I think the darkness of Miles Davis's skin, instead of seeing that as a liability, he saw that as an asset. It was very different from anything that was projected on television or in movies at that time. Miles turned that into something cool, something desirable.
Cool. And that's what it's like, the birth of cool is what you call this thing, because that's what he does with his music. It's a birth of cool.
Yeah, Miles, as we're making the film, we're like, okay, so Miles is just the coolest guy that ever lived. I mean, he just is, you know? I mean, you know, as somebody says in the film, you know, Miles had the cars, the fast cars, the snappy clothes. You know, the Miles had his clothes tailored. He had beautiful women. One of the musicians says, you know, we not only wanted to play with Miles, we wanted to be Miles. That's who we wanted to be. So Miles is this, you know, has all these things going for him, but he also has this chip on his shoulder, you know, and, you know, that part of that was his reaction to the racism that he was exposed to. He was born in 1926, the racism that he's exposed to in that America. And you know, he is that person.
And he was always innovating in a way. I mean, this creativity is like, don't stand still. Let me try a whole new form of music.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's who Miles was, you know, to our great benefit and sometimes to his own detriment. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you know, he breaks up groups just because he wants to do something else. You know, there's a great scene in the film where he asks Ron Carter, you know, he has what's one of the greatest groups ever, and he asks Ron Carter to play electric bass, and Ron's no. And Miles is like, okay, well then bye. You know, I mean, that's kind of how it was with Miles. You know, it was, he had this thing where he constantly had to change, he constantly had to create. And you know, I think again, for us listening to it, it's great because he made great music in so many different ways. But for him, sometimes personally, it was hard.
Your next big project, I think, is on the Atlantic slave trade, and you're going to try to treat it as a business.
Right. Yeah, we're working on a four-part series for PBS on the Atlantic slave trade. We're just starting now. And I think that, you know, one of the things we wanted to try to do is say, you know, look, this was the first global business. This was a business that set so many things in motion. You know, shipping, banking, insurance, all of these things came out of the slave trade, and you know, we it's something we never look at. So this is a four-part series on the trade. It's not on slavery. It's on the trade, which was a business that was, you know, Europe, Africa, North America, South America, the Caribbean were all involved in the slave trade. So it's the first real global business in the world.
One of the small things you did that I find very interesting as I looked at it was a training video you did for the Starbucks company. Yeah. Of what it's like to be in public and be black.
Especially being a teen of color, they assume that you're doing something bad.
I feel like I'm disturbing people by just being there. Like, people feel uncomfortable when I walk in.
Explain why you did that and what you conveyed there.
Yeah, well, Starbucks came to me after they had the incident where the two guys were arrested in Starbucks in Philly, and they decided that they were going to close their stores down and kind of have a training session for their employees, and they wanted to do a video. And so what we came up with was an idea of African Americans and others just talking to the camera about how we feel in public spaces, and that, you know, so many times we don't feel entirely welcomed, you know, and that it has its roots in the civil rights movement, which a large part of the civil rights movement was to say everybody is equal in public spaces, right? So you could go to a public library, you can go to a park, you can go to a swimming pool, but we still, as African Americans, don't feel welcomed so many times when we walk into stores and other places.
Did you have any reservations about working with Starbucks and to try to help smooth their situation over?
I mean, you know, for a second when they called me, you know, I wanted to meet with them. But then when I met with them, I realized, I mean, they were totally honest about it. You know, I mean, they closed down their stores. They didn't have to do that. I think Starbucks, in some ways, they were really shaken by this, and they really wanted to try to make it right. And so I felt, you know, very comfortable in trying to help.
Did we move on too quickly?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think there's a lot more discussion to be had. I think it's really, it's an important discussion. And you know, I learned so much from doing the film because, you know, I didn't know that there were things that I didn't talk about. You know, I didn't ever think about the fact that, you know, I am not comfortable going into a lot of places. Or it's not even uncomfort. It's that just little, you know, you put your hand on the door and you're like, okay, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, what might happen. And I think that's important to talk about.
Name of your company is Firelight Media. And it's important for Firelight to be training a next generation, especially of African Americans, who can own the story and tell the story?
Yeah, well, we have a documentary lab where we train filmmakers of color of all races, so Black, Latino, Asian, all races, and we have between 10 and 15 filmmakers who we mentor who are in the lab at the same time. There have been, I think, over 80 filmmakers who have graduated the lab. Filmmakers who are making full-length films. They've been on all different networks. We've had multiple films at Sundance. One of our films just won an award at Sundance this year. Emmys, Peabody's, DuPont's, all those things our films have won.
And where do you see it going over the next 10, 15 years?
Our next step that we're really pushing to do and we're raising money to do is to have a move for the filmmakers to make their second film. Mm-hmm. Because what we're finding is people who have been through the lab, they win a DuPont, or they win a Peabody, they win an Emmy, and it's still hard for them to get their foot in the door for that second film. So what we want to try to do is be able to give filmmakers seed money, mentorship, to get that second film made. Because when I made my second film, when I made $2 and a Dream, William Greaves, who was kind of my mentor, said to me, "Well, Stanley, you've done it twice. They can't say it's an accident. You're on your way."
Stanley Nelson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Words of support from the maestro. That is it for now. Remember, you can always listen to our podcast, see us online at amanpour.com, and follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.